Penguin Random House Audio presents The Friday Afternoon Club, A Family Memoir. This is the author, Griffin Dunn. To my brother Alex, who was there through it all. It's very difficult to escape your background. You know, I don't think it's necessary to even try to escape it. More and more, I start to think that it's necessary to see exactly what it is that you inherited on both sides of the stick. Your timidity, your courage, your self-deceit, and your honesty, and all the rest of it. Sam Shepard. Hey, kiddo, what can I say? I'm a work in progress. Dominic Dunn. Prologue. At 3 a.m., during the early hours of Halloween 1982, Detective Harold Johnson of the West Hollywood Homicide Division rang the doorbell of my mother's house in the flats of Beverly Hills. Marina, her live-in housekeeper, woke to the sound and let the detective in. She expected she'd have to disturb Mrs. Dunn's sleep, but when she led Johnson into her bedroom, the lights were on and Mom was already sitting up in bed, bracing herself for news that is never good at that time of night. The first thing that caught Johnson's eye was my mother's wheelchair. He was a tough Irish cop who'd made countless house calls like this before, but never to a lady like Mrs. Ellen Griffin Dunn of 528 North Crescent Drive. He took in the wheelchair, the collection of glass hippos lining the shelves of an overstuffed bookcase, a bowl of rosebuds floating in water, and a black cat lying protectively on her lap, both waiting for the detective to get to the reason for his visit. The closest murderer had ever come to this house was in the pages of the George Simenon novel the detective clocked on Mrs. Dunn's bedside table. Detective Johnson gently informed my mother that her daughter had been strangled by a man named John Sweeney. At this moment, Dominique Dunn was still alive, although she had been placed on life support at Cedars-Sinai Hospital. Glancing once more at my mom's wheelchair, the detective asked if there was anyone she'd like to call. My father was the first and only person who came to mind. She reached for the phone, but it fell to the floor, scaring the cat off her lap. Her hands trembled so much she fumbled the number on the rotary dial. She gave up and handed the phone to the detective and told him Dad's number in New York City. "Thank you," she said when he handed it back. "Nick, I'm here with a homicide detective named... I'm sorry, I forgot your name." "Detective Harold Johnson. Would you like me to speak to him?" "Yes, please. Thank you." That's another thing Johnson noticed about my mother that was unusual in his line of work. Even when told her daughter was on life support, she was unfailingly polite. After delivering the news to my father, he handed her back the phone. "Nick," she said, "I need you. I'll be on the next plane." After they hung up, Dad's next call was to me at my apartment, three blocks from his. "I can't tell if I'm dreaming now or what," he said after relaying his conversation with Johnston. I had 2 hours of sleep and the taste of cocaine still lingered in the back of my throat, so I took a few moments to focus. "Wait, did you say homicide detective?" I asked, bolting out of bed. "Griffin, get over here now. I need you." I was 27 years old, but never felt more like a lost little boy. Part 1. 1. My mother was the only child of a cattle rancher. Her father's 30,000-acre ranch was called the Yerba Buena, situated in Nogales, Arizona, a border town just north of Sonora. Tom Griffin chose to raise Santa Gertrudis cattle, a risky venture for a city slicker from Chicago. But at last he'd fulfilled his dream to return to Arizona's high desert, where as a child he was sent to cure his weak lungs. Tom was born into a socially prominent family that had made its fortune in the Griffin Wheel Company, which manufactured wheels for all the Pullman train cars that crossed America. His uncles were playboys and philanderers whose shenanigans often found their way into the gossip columns of Chicago dailies. In the mid-1920s, my great-great-uncle George Griffin died of a heart attack while in bed with his mistress aboard his yacht off the coast of Palm Beach, Florida. The mistress was Rose Davies, sister of the movie star Marion Davies, who happened to be the mistress of the publishing magnate William Randolph Hearst. So elaborate measures were taken to prevent a national scandal. Ms. Davies was snuck ashore in the dead of night and caught the next sleeper car to Los Angeles, with actual Griffin wheels whirling beneath her berth. Meanwhile, George Griffin's steadfast crew dressed him in pajamas, loaded him onto the tender, and checked his corpse into the Breakers Hotel. After tucking him in, the vice president of the Griffin Wheel Company solemnly called George's wife to say that her husband had just died peacefully in his sleep. His wife, my great-great-aunt Helen Prinville Griffin, was no stranger to wealth, having been a doyen of Washington, D.C. society who summered in Newport, Rhode Island. At the moment when Mrs. Griffin had been notified of her husband's death, she was in bed with her lover at the Hotel Del Coronado in California, and took the news that she was a widow rather well. She untwined herself from the arms of Admiral Paul Henry Bastido, who served under Secretary of the Navy Franklin Roosevelt, and proposed that they get married in the morning so he could be her date at her late husband's funeral. To the tabloid's delight, the newlyweds took Helen Prinville Griffin Bastido's private railway car to Lake Forest, Illinois, to attend the service. The act so outraged the Griffin family that they used their juice with Union Pacific to divert the train and the unlucky passengers coupled to Helen's private car. The train choo-chooed deep into Wisconsin, denying the newlyweds their grand entrance to the funeral. The family were less successful trying to have Helen cut from George Griffin's will, and she inherited every cent of his enormous fortune. Scandal visited the next generation of Griffins a decade later, on the day of Tom's wedding to a woman from an equally prominent family. Approaching the church in the back of a limousine, he watched the crowd of guests and photographers awaiting his arrival and told the chauffeur to keep driving all the way to Chicago Union Station. Once there, still in top hat and tails, he boarded a Pullman car on Griffin wheels, and headed westward to begin his new life as a rancher in Nogales. As kids, we loved when Mom took us to Nogales. My younger brother and sister and I used to cross the border into Mexico on foot with a pack of cousins, as easily as going through a subway turnstile. We rambled up a hill to reach a restaurant called La Roca, set on top of a large rock. At the bottom of the rock, a cave, once a prison, used to shelter a cantina called La Caverna. La Roca was built above only when La Caverna burned down under suspicious circumstances. Tom Griffin was long dead by then and was spared the demise of his favorite haunt, where he famously sat at his usual table with a parrot on his shoulder who'd bite anyone who got too close. As much as he tried, he never mastered Spanish as well as his parrot, but he made up colorful words that sounded like the language, and the locals always got the gist. One of my grandfather's favorite requests was for the mariachis to play El Ternero Perdido, or The Lost Calf. The song required an alto trumpeter to go outside the bar way down the block to toot his horn as the lost calf. A chorus of mariachis sang as the worried cows called out for their lost calf. And then there was a solo, presumably the mother of the calf, who pleaded, oh, where is my little lost calf? The tension would build, and suddenly the audience would hear the lost calf somewhere far off. His trumpet sounded like a lost child, crying for its mother. When the patrons of La Caverna heard the lost calf, they'd go apeshit, and Tom's parrot would squawk at the top of his tiny lungs. Then the door...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?